It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at a conservationist who spent his boyhood in Wisconsin and was inspired by the nature around him. That's in today's Wisconsin Legends segment.
First, when you think of startups and entrepreneurs, you might think of places on the coast like San Francisco or New York, and that may be for a good reason. A recent report from the Kauffman Foundation found the Midwest has the lowest rate of entrepreneurial activity of any region in the country, with the West Coast having the highest.
And in that report, Wisconsin ranks particularly poorly at 45th in the nation. Despite these low numbers, Wisconsin entrepreneurs are hopeful, and according to WisBusiness.com, some venture capitalists think the Midwest is ripe for a technology boom.
In pursuit of that boom, entrepreneurs from across the state met in Madison to share their stories and aspirations at the 2014 Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Conference this week. It ended yesterday. Now Tom Still joins us to tell us how it went. He's president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be on.
Well, does the Wisconsin entrepreneur have a typical profile?
Wisconsin entrepreneurs in many ways look like entrepreneurs elsewhere. There are different types. There are the classic mom-and-pop businesses. There are folks who start lifestyle businesses. I think some people who start businesses around social causes. And then there are those who I like to call gazelles, the really high-growth companies that are sometimes in the tech space and are often where you see a lot of the job creation overall. And our group, the Wisconsin Technology Council, tries to work across all those spectrums, but with a bit of a focus on the gazelles, those who are going to have that kind of high growth.
Well, as we mentioned, Wisconsin ranks as one of the states with the lowest rates of entrepreneurial activity in the country. I guess worrisome because you're looking for those job creators, those gazelles. What keeps people from starting businesses in Wisconsin?
Yeah, and first, a little more about those numbers. They lag by a couple of years. And they probably hit Wisconsin about the time the Great Recession was really just passing through the state, so that didn't help. And I think, too, with the entire upper Midwest, because immigration rates are a bit lower, and immigrants, especially into some of the coastal areas, well, what do? They often start businesses. And they're often the kind of the mom-and-pop variety. So the Kauffman numbers sort of capture all of that. But when it comes to high-growth entrepreneurs, I think Wisconsin is making good progress.
Well, the recession would have been reflected in all of the rates across the country. Has Wisconsin caught up to the average?
It is starting to. Our sense is, and we see this in a lot of ways, the deals that are invested in, the kinds of people who are coming to our events, the kind of investor activity that's going on, all of that adds up that at least in this sector, that high-growth sector, we're seeing progress. In 2012, for example, there were 74 companies in Wisconsin that had some kind of angel or venture capital investment. In 2013, that was up to 86. At our conference in Madison this week, a number of investors from outside Wisconsin were here, and they were very bullish on what they're seeing in the state in terms of companies in certain sectors, health information technology, medical devices, medical imaging, software, mobile apps, advanced manufacturing. Wisconsin's portfolio of high-growth companies is far more diverse today than it was 5 or 10 years ago.
So in terms of why Wisconsin dipped so low a couple of years ago, now you're saying it's rebounding, but why do you think Wisconsin took such a big dip comparative to the rest of the country?
Oh, it's always been down there in terms of it's always been somewhere in the 40s. It was the case. It's really always been the case in some ways because we're a state that's been dependent on, for a long time, larger manufacturing companies, agriculture, tourism, the big three. And I hope we can continue to enjoy great success in those sectors. But it often tends to be that you don't see a lot of spinoffs and new company creation in those sectors as well. So that combined what I described in terms of immigration and the fact that many immigrants are very industrious and they start businesses and we don't see as many as others, I think that's always been a factor in Wisconsin. It's not like we fell from the top 20 or even the top 30 into the 40s. We have more or less been there for a long time. Now, what's changed? Again, what I see is the high growth sector and the companies that are coming out that have some kind of a tech emphasis. We just completed our governor's business plan contest, and a great collection of entries in that in terms of the finalists. So in that part of the entrepreneurial spectrum where we focus, I see progress.
So what has changed then? Over is it just that the economy in general is taking an upturn, or are you seeing a cultural shift in the way that Wisconsin supports businesses and entrepreneurs?
Well, in terms of a cultural shift, I think there's a generation that probably didn't think as much about starting companies, about being entrepreneurial. They were more likely to work for major existing companies and perhaps for a long time. I think what we're seeing with the millennials and others is that there is more of a startup culture, again, especially in the high growth side, where they see the advantages of starting a business and what it can do for them, throughout the course of their careers. I'm amazed by how much is going on in colleges and universities and tech colleges around Wisconsin. You had to look pretty hard 10, 15 years ago to find an entrepreneurship program on pretty much any campus outside maybe Marquette and UW-Madison. Today, it's embedded in a number of campuses around the state, and we're beginning to see the results. It's sort of like professional baseball, where you've got a major leagues, but you got to have the farm system to support it. And I think Wisconsin's doing a good job of building that farm system.
Well, to take another aspect of this, the common wisdom among economic conservatives, including Governor Scott Walker, is that low taxes will support business growth. And how would you say entrepreneurs are responding to the rates of small business taxation here in Wisconsin?
Entrepreneurs, almost by definition, for the first year, two, three, whatever the life of their company, they're probably not making much money. That's a time where they are investing money and doing that to help grow the business. But during that time, they may not have a profit in a taxable sense. So for a while, taxes don't matter as much to them. They are more interested in the sort of the overall support system that they may see in any given state, where they might find the kinds of workers they need, where they might find the kind of entrepreneurial culture or climate within any given community. A lot of those factors matter as much to them as at that early stage as taxes. And because so many of their businesses can be online or really somehow internet-based, increasingly they can do that from a lot of different places in Wisconsin. So it's less about at least in those early stages about taxes, and more about some of the other elements of business that add up to there's still an overall cost factor, but taxes are only a portion of that.
If you could propose one change, one policy that you think would make Wisconsin a better place to start a business, what would it be?
I think some of the things that have gotten underway are all pointed toward making capital more available. There's been some progress there, but I think we can continue to make that kind of progress. There was a $25 million state investment in what's called a fund of funds that will be matched by private dollars over time. That is a good start. I think the state should continue to look at that. I think there are a few quirks in Wisconsin law that appear to apply mainly to these young companies that you don't see in some other states that, again, are all about capital. You know, but a lot of this is not about passing a law to make things better. It's about trying to send the message that Wisconsin is a good place for entrepreneurs and that investors who are outside the state can come here and find good deals. And indeed, at our Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Conference this week, there were investors from a lot of different places who were very bullish on the state and what they see. You know, in the last week and a half, 2 weeks alone, there's been about $20 million invested in Wisconsin companies. That's a pretty furious pace. If that were to keep up the rest of the year, we'd have a lot better year in 2014 than there was in 2013.
We're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. This week, entrepreneurs from around the state met in Madison for the 2014 Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Conference.
When we think of famous environmentalists and conservationists that have called Wisconsin home, Aldo Leopold, Gaylord Nelson are a couple of the names that immediately spring to mind. Our next guest says we should think about adding another name to that list, Sigurd Olson.
Well, he was born in Chicago and did a lot of his work in Minnesota. He spent his early years growing up in northern Wisconsin, where he cultivated his love for nature and was inspired to spend his life fighting for it.
Today in Wisconsin Legends, we look at the legacy of Sigurd Olson. Here to help us do that is Kristen Eggerling. She's the author of Breath of Wilderness, The Life of Sigurd Olson. Kristen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, sometimes when you read about somebody famous, there's no direct line from their childhood to what they were famous for. In this case, there really is. This was a young kid who was happy outside and wasn't happy unless he was outside.
That's right. He spent as much time as he could outside. He couldn't stand being indoors in school, in church. He wanted to be outdoors.
And he was up in the Prentice area, I think you write, in northern Wisconsin. What was it that he loved about being outside in northern Wisconsin?
Well, he loved to go out into the woods and hunt and just take it all in. He loved all the animals and everything about it.
And sometimes he maybe got a little too close. One of his life lessons was never trust a moose, no matter where you find it. How did he come by that bit of wisdom?
Well, that was a little later on, and he'd always wanted to ride a moose. And so he got this idea that if he could jump on this moose, and he did, obviously the moose was not very happy. He was lucky to escape serious injury.
And now a lot of people grow up loving to be outside. What was it about Sigurd Olson that led him to not just love nature, but make the transition to devoting his life to conservation and protecting the wilderness he loved?
Sig felt a spiritual connection with the outdoors. It fed his soul, and it was his passion and his purpose in life. And once he always loved being outdoors, but then when he saw the outdoors being threatened, he knew that his role was to stand up and do what he could to protect it.
And again, early on, he, when faced with a choice between nature and something else, he chose nature. I think that led to him being kicked off of his high school football team. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, that's a good story about him. It was at Northland College, and he played on the football team there, and he was one of the best players on the team. But he had an opportunity. The weather was just right for bluebills, and he went out hunting, spent the weekend hunting, and skipped the most important game of the year. They lost the game, and the coach kicked him off the team and told him, never play football again.
Wow. And he, through his life, he talked about wilderness and he talked about nature to anyone who would listen. And sometimes even people in his family thought maybe Sig a little break from the wilderness. Sometimes he just talked about nothing else.
Yeah. And Sig's son, Bob, who I've gotten to know, he still lives in Wisconsin. And he says it got to be too much at times. He just wouldn't talk about anything else.
He did a lot of things, wilderness guide, writer. Let's talk about some of his first legal battles, his efforts to preserve parts of nature. What was his first big fight?
The first big fight was in 1923. It was called A Road to Every Lake. the Chamber of Commerce and some business interests wanted to build a road to every lake in the wilderness, which would have made it not the wilderness anymore. It would have destroyed it. The next one was a power plant with dams that was being proposed, and it would have flooded all the islands in the wilderness and much of the lands. And then the next one was an airplane traffic ban. After World War II, pilots came back from the war, and they started flying in people into resorts that you could only get to by plane. And it just ruined the outdoors. On one canoe trip, SIG counted a plane every 8 minutes for 6 straight hours.
Now, thinking about the natural environment this way, it's pretty common, a pretty big environmental movement now. But in SIG's time, when he was starting this, was he an oddity? Was he a rare sort of person?
Yeah, I think he was. You know, the first fight when the Road to Every Lake was proposed, he thought, you know, how am I going to fight this? But he had guided some well-known people. And so he called them, and they said, yeah, they would lend their support. And so they helped teach him how to stand up for the wilderness. But it's not like his neighbors were doing that. He was somewhat of an oddity.
One of his biggest legacies came after he moved from Wisconsin next door to Minnesota, up the northern part of the state. What wildlife area there did he help bring into reality?
Well, the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. We very much can thank SIG for that wilderness area today. It would not be there, I don't think, if it wasn't for him.
And he was not, he was part of a wider effort, but he was one of the few conservationists actually living in the affected area. Was he popular with his neighbors all the time for his efforts to protect that?
He was not popular with his neighbors. They saw him as an enemy, as a traitor, because they couldn't believe that he was on the other side. People moved across the street when they met him. They didn't serve him in the grocery store. They would move to another pew at church. They didn't want anything to do with him.
The idea being that his efforts to protect nature would stop logging and other jobs.
That's right, and allowing them to enjoy the wilderness. They wanted to be able to snowmobile. They wanted to be able to take their motorized boats anywhere they could, and they saw those things being threatened by his acts.
And then at the federal level, he was a big part of working on the Wilderness Act of 1964. What part did he play in passing that?
Well, he helped craft the Wilderness Act, and he worked a lot. He worked with Minnesota legislation, but he worked on the national level for that and worked very hard to get that passed.
And how did he inspire maybe the next generation of conservationists? Do people look to him as a mentor, as a guiding light?
I think they really do. People who had a personal connection obviously did. He had a pen pal relationship with a young girl. She was 12 years old, and it inspired her to stay active in the environment. He had a way of connecting with people on such an emotional and personal level. And anyone who wrote to him, he wrote them back and established long-term relationships. And that was a way of really having a following. And he continues to have a following today.
You talked, as you mentioned, to family members, people who knew or corresponded with him. Did you get a sense of what he was like as a person?
He had a good sense of humor, very warm, a character. Unfortunately, I never got to meet him, but I really wish I had, because he sounds like just a great guy. Anyone who's met him has very good things to say about him.
And maybe anyone who paddles up there in Minnesota will think about him now after this book.
That's right. And, you know, people, when he was alive and he was living in Ely, people who would go to the Boundary Waters, they made a point of stopping at his house to meet him before they went into the Boundary Waters or when they got back. And SIG and Elizabeth always invited folks in and served them coffee and cookies and got to know them.
All right, Kristen, thank you so much for being here and sharing his story with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was writer Kristen Eggerling. We've been talking about her new book, Breath of Wilderness, The Life of Sigurd Olsen, in this edition of Wisconsin Legends.
Co-sleeping has been in the news over the past couple of years. Public health campaigns in Milwaukee, Dane County, and elsewhere have warned of the dangers of parents sleeping with infants after deaths blamed on co-sleeping.
But our next guests say those campaigns overlook bigger issues of health and safety and that co-sleeping in and of itself should not be the main focus.
Ingrid Anderson is with us in studio. She's a nurse midwife in Madison and a member of the campaign Safe Conversations for Safe Sleep, Real People, Real Life. Ingrid, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Also with us is James McKenna, professor of anthropology and director of the Mother-Baby Behavioral Sleep Lab at the University of Notre Dame. James, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
Ingrid, let's start with you. You've written this piece about co-sleeping and about some of the other factors that go into the problems and the deaths that have occurred. What is the main message from the anti-co-sleeping efforts that you've seen here in Wisconsin?
Well, that sleeping with your baby is a danger, that you're endangering the life of your baby by sleeping with your baby. Newborn through 6 months is the period of time that babies are primarily at risk for a sudden unexpected infant deaths. And our coalition, which is a group of midwives, physicians, nurses, mental health professionals, educators, lactation consultants, social justice activists, even a legislator, got together because we're worried about that message.
And James, let's bring you in on this. Is co-sleeping in and of itself inherently dangerous?
No, it isn't at all. And that's the basis of the differences of opinion that have shaped the, quote, debate, unquote. I've always argued that it should never have been a debate, that it's a discourse, because co-sleeping in the form of bed sharing, and please keep in mind that the distinctions and definitions are critical here. Co-sleeping is a generic class of behaviors that involve either separate surface co-sleeping or bed sharing. And the importance is, and the good news is, that separate surface co-sleeping, within which the parent and the baby are within sensory access and range of each other, such as room sharing, is agreed by all. The baby should never sleep outside the supervision of an adult. And therefore, for example, saying, oh, co-sleeping is dangerous is really inappropriate, because actually separate surface co-sleeping is indeed co-sleeping. But the issue comes with bed sharing, and bed sharing can be either safe when it's practiced with precautions and with breastfeeding mothers, or on the other end of a continuum, when it's practiced by individuals that are, you know, unable to control the bed and the circumstances within which they live. They might have smoked during their pregnancy, there are other children in the bed, the mattress is soft, so on and so forth. Then obviously this same ostensible behavior, bed sharing, becomes quite different and is indeed risky.
And Ingrid, you want to make this conversation one that's more complex, that takes into account different factors. What are things that are missing from this conversation when it comes to the issue of co-sleeping?
Well, I knew that there were gaps in the county message, and it's now a national message initiated by the American Academy of Pediatrics. Because I know many parents in Europe who are actually told by their midwife or pediatrician to sleep with their baby, to share a bed, and they're given safe bed sharing guidelines. There are nice guidelines actually put out by UNICEF and the World Health Organization for parents who decide to share a bed thoughtfully, safely with their baby. And that is what these parents I know in Europe will make breastfeeding easier, make sleep easier, and literally make a new family get off to a better start. But even as James McKenna points out in some of his articles, in America, most parents bed share at some point in their infant's first year. And the reason, again, is because bed sharing clearly works for so many parents. In my practice, virtually 100% safely bed share, and tell me all the time that they would experience, life would just be nearly impossible, especially in the first several weeks, if they did not. So we're asking, the Safe Conversations for Safe Sleep Coalition is asking, why is bed sharing safe for most babies in the world, and when is bed sharing unsafe for babies?
And James, how would you answer that question? What do you think we're missing when we just sort of say co-sleeping bad, stop doing it. We have the campaign now, share the room, not the bed. What is wrong when we leave nuance out of the conversation, do you think?
Well, first of all, it pathologizes and it attempts to stigmatize what is, in fact, universal human behavior. It's a little bit, you could even say, insofar as we're trying to suppress natural human instincts to reach for your baby in the middle of the night and put them into contact with you, which is what all babies are, contact seekers, and they negotiate their own ways into their parents' bed because that's what they need. But I think first and foremost, you have to know that this was 7 to 8 people that made this decision for millions of parents. And as we speak, there are probably, with 4 million babies practically being born and conservative estimates of up to 42% of parents that bed share, you're talking about probably 2 million parents in our country that are at least intermittently bed sharing. To actually deprive these parents of an instinctual kind of behavior, particularly for breastfeeding mothers, and to actually hold back information that can be indeed life-saving insofar as reducing the risks of bed sharing, well, it's completely unethical. It shouldn't even be, you know, something that we have to argue with. You know, institutional review boards go through and they review any kind of research done on human beings, and one of the requirements by virtue of any research is that both benefits and risks and all information be revealed to those that might be participating in your research. It's really unthinkable that we have ways of actually reducing the risks, such as simply telling or discriminating between the types of bed sharing that can take place. By holding back that information, we're actually putting many infants at risk. And I'm talking about pretty simple things like not having gaps around your bed, not having other children in your bed, that indeed, because of the physiological differences of breastfeeding bed sharing mothers compared with bottle feeding bed sharing mothers, it's probably wise for a bottle feeding mom to have her baby sleeping alongside her baby in a separate surface rather than in the bed, because our own research has documented the physiology by way of polysomnographs, you know, looking at brain waves and mother's breathing and baby's breathing and heart rates, etc. And we know that the breastfeeding bed sharing mother-baby pair physiologically and behaviorally is very, very different than the bottle feeding bed sharing pair.
So there are things you do that can make it more dangerous, and there's a safe way to do it is the message I'm getting from both of you. But James, do you think there's any danger in making the message more complex? Because right now you've got something that's very simple to understand, and maybe that's the goal, is to reduce these deaths.
But the bed sharing, the recommendation isn't working. In the last 15 years, the American Academy of Pediatrics, against many people's advice, made this declarative and de facto simplified recommendation. And do you know how the rates of bed sharing have changed during this period? They've doubled and tripled across every ethnic group in the country, with 70% of new mothers in Los Angeles County alone intermittently bed sharing with their new babies. When you find that kind of statistic, there's some reason. You don't have that many irresponsible parents in your community. What you're revealing is that once breastfeeding especially came into the picture, the biological interdependence between sleep and physiology and the baby's feeding needs and the proximity that the baby needs to, you know, accommodate breastfeeding is really simply irrepressible. So, I mean, we can talk all we want what might be ideal, but you have to look at what the behavior is actually, what behavior is actually finding expression. And, you know, either we've given rise to a completely insensitive group of citizens, which is most unlikely, or that mothers and babies are finding a way to make their breastfeeding work insofar as bed sharing is concerned. I agree, and I'm fairly conservative on the part of bottle feeding babies having their babies alongside them, but not in the beds. But somewhat ironically, most of the deaths are actually occurring in non-breastfeeding subgroups, which are actually bed sharing at higher rates. And part of those dangers is the differences where the baby's placed, how the baby behaves, when the mother is not bottle feeding, and how the baby sleep architecture unfolds. Babies that are bottle fed sleep in deeper stages of sleep, from which it's much more difficult to arouse from, to terminate apneas, compared with breastfeeding babies who spend more of their time in a lighter stage one or stage two sleep than deep sleep, that makes it easier, as all babies must do, to arouse quick to terminate what is normative as regards their breathing, and that is the experience of apnea, short little apneas that the baby's awake from to reinitiate the breathing.
All right, we're going to leave it there for now and come back, continue our conversation with Ingrid Anderson and James McKenna. We're talking about co-sleeping and infant health and safety. Our nurse midwife joins us in studio, Ingrid Anderson. We're also talking with Notre Dame anthropologist James McKenna.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with public health campaigns that are trying to get people to stop co-sleeping, stop bed sharing in particular? Or do you think the risks are overstated, the benefits overlooked? What do you think our priorities should be when it comes to infant health and safety? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation about co-sleeping and infant health and safety. Staying with us, we have Wisconsin nurse midwife Ingrid Anderson, a member of the Safe Conversations for Safe Sleep campaign, and James McKenna, a Notre Dame anthropology professor who studies parents, kids, and how they sleep.
You can join with your thoughts and your experiences at 800-642-1234. Did you or do you bring infants into bed for the night? Do you think co-sleeping is unfairly blamed as a hazard to infant safety? Or do you agree with public health campaigns that say keep the kids in the crib? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. And Ingrid, if you had it your way, what would these public health campaigns, what would they focus on?
Well, Dr. McKenna is right. You know, here in Dane County, 2/3 of the infant deaths were bottle-fed infants. So I would love to see the message be focused around supporting mothers to successfully breastfeed. Again, not to blame the mother for not breastfeeding, but to have a really, truly cultural level, public health level, global media image driven support campaign as a call for action for breastfeeding. And this was done very loudly by the Surgeon General in 2011 when she shared a lot of facts about sudden infant deaths and the protection of breastfeeding. And we already knew back then that 56% higher risk of SIDS to babies who were bottle-fed over breastfeeding. So breastfeeding is just a huge protection, not only for the baby, of course, for that baby's health for a lifetime and maybe even generations to come, but for the mother's health as well.
And Ingrid, you've also said that sometimes there is mother shaming that goes hand-in-hand with these campaigns. What do you see happening?
Well, I think there's always a risk with abstinence messages that it focuses heavily on the individual. And in our coalition, as parents and health workers, we know abstinence messages such as never sleep with your baby often don't work and sometimes backfire. For example, one physician in our group talks about how now daily parents are coming in to see her who are so terrified at the thought of lying down in bed with their infant that instead they pass out with their baby in an armchair, which is far more dangerous for anyone sleeping with a baby due to smothering and entrapment risks. So she says this has become so universal now, babies in armchairs with parents terrified to go into bed with them and sleep more safely in a bed sharing situation that, in her words, the couch has just replaced the bed.
All right, let's go to our phones right now and take a call from Becky, who joins us in Sheboygan. Hi, Becky.
Hi. You actually just addressed my exact concern. We're a bed-sharing family, and we have I have a three-month-old who we're currently bed-sharing with, and then two older children who we have done the same. And I guess my biggest concern is exactly what you said, is that these campaigns seem to, I've always likened them to abstinence-only sex education, where they just simply say, don't do it, but you know that people are going to do it anyway. And so I've always thought, why not teach people how to do it safely? And I'm just wondering, like, in all the research I've read, it never seems to differentiate for different conditions where there have been deaths. And, you know, I guess my comment is exactly what you just addressed, is that people accidentally co-sleep, and people, you know, there have been accidents where somebody slips between the cushions of the couches. And what has your research shown, you know, in regards to that?
All right. Thank you for the comments and the questions, Becky. And James, let's go to you. What would you say to Becky?
I would say, well, there are definitely dangerous forms of co-sleeping, and they're all well-known. Couch sleeping is one of them, obviously, and there's sleeping on futons and water beds. I always recommend, I have some guidelines on my website in case anyone's interested, safety guidelines, and I say, well, if you really are sure you're going to routinely bed share, then you should probably pull your bed apart and put the mattress and the box spring in the middle of the floor to just avoid the kinds of structural dangers such as gaps and light tables, etc. So certainly there are very many adverse factors that would recommend against bed sharing, and or at least, at very least, would require parents to take caution. But as Ingrid was saying, you would just be amazed at how different the whole architecture and social and behavioral landscape of the bed changes when that mother is breastfeeding. It just isn't the breast milk or the breast milk delivery and how amazing that is, but it's just the actual transaction between the mother and baby. Mom is able to respond much more quickly to the baby because she's in lighter stages of sleep as well, because of the kind of synchronous arousals each of the partners is exhibiting toward the other. And we found, rather than moms habituating, that is getting used to the baby there and perhaps not being as sensitive, they actually through time become even more sensitive. We found, for example, that 64% of the times that mother had a brief awakening, they were explained by her baby having aroused plus or minus 2 seconds before she arose. Hmm. Similarly, about 40% of the baby's arousals occurred or could be explained by the mother having aroused plus or minus 2 seconds before the baby aroused.
James, because I don't want to run out of time, and I want to make sure we get this in, if someone looks at the data out there and makes a choice, either to co-sleep, to have a surface next to the bed, or maybe even to share a bed, could you quickly run us through some guidelines for doing it safely, keeping in mind that people should probably do as much research
sure,
as they can
absolutely.
Before they try to do this, but what are the guidelines for safe sleeping?
I just want to comment and compliment you on making that point, because it is about empowering parents, and they are, when informed, in the best position to make the right decisions for their families, etc. But obviously, I happen to think that if there is no breastfeeding going on, and this isn't yet again to criticize anyone, not just actually looking at the data, that breastfeeding changes the physiology of sleep for both the mother and the baby, the position the baby is occupying, and the orientation and the arousal and oxygenation of each as we've studied this. So insofar as breastfeeding does so much positive and is associated with many, many lower deaths, it's best for a mom and baby to still sleep within proximity of each other if bottle feeding, but to have the baby alongside in a pack and play or a crib, because what's really important here is the proactive ability of moms to monitor their babies through sensory cues and signals, and absolutely similarly the ability of the baby, which it is designed to do, to hear the sounds, to respond to touch, to even respond to mother's smells and olfactory, what's called olfactory stimuli that keeps babies aroused. So you can get that by separate surface co-sleeping as long as the main requirement is fulfilled. And that is sensory access, being able to be close enough that each can monitor the other. So that was historic, actually, when the American Academy of Pediatrics in 2005 said, well, indeed, babies should never sleep outside the supervision of a parent. The debate, unfortunately, has occurred over the form that co-sleeping should take. And as you know, bed sharing has been not really dealt with insofar as the diversity of evidence that shows it can really be made quite safe and indeed protective of the baby.
I want to go back to our callers now. Take Shannon next in Westby. Hi, Shannon.
Hi. I just wanted to say I appreciate this program. I'm bed sharing and breastfeeding my almost one-year-old, and I wish we would have done it sooner. I feel like I wasted a lot of time and energy trying to get him, you know, to sleep in the crib, and I just wish I would have done it sooner, and it has to do, I think, a lot with trying to do the what everyone else thinks you should be doing is the crib in the other room, which works for a lot of people, but didn't work for our acid reflux baby who doesn't like to sleep. And it's just been so much better since we did it and did it safely and researched it. So that's my comment.
Okay. Thank you, Shannon. And Ingrid, we've got about a minute. What is your response to Shannon, what she's been going through?
Well, she's the parent we're talking to. Our coalition just really wants new mothers to know and new parents to know that their community cares about their realities. And we're committed to the right, to her right, to all new parents' rights to humane support and expectations of themselves and their babies. We're not a very humane culture when it comes to supporting and valuing the work of new mothers. We're one of only three countries in the world, alongside Papua New Guinea and the Persian monarchy of Oman, that doesn't pay for some maternity leave. And we have the shortest unpaid maternity leave of all Western countries. So I'm really thrilled that Wisconsin and Dane County Public Health have elevated this to a public health question. The focus needs to go upstream mm-hmm. from bed sharing to other public health disparities and questions.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Ingrid, thank you much for joining us. James, I want to thank you as well.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
I'm speaking to Ingrid Anderson, a nurse midwife in Madison and a member of the Safe Conversations for Safe Sleep campaign, and also James McKenna, professor of anthropology and director of the Mother-Baby Behavioral Sleep Lab at Notre Dame.